He said the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, which is the word of God that you can use to defeat Satan. And he said that if you tell Satan that he must flee, that he have no authority over you, they said if you resist Satan, he must flee. That's the sword. That's the word of God. If you tell Satan, say, you have no authority, you have no power over me, you using the word of God. That's the sword. And then it says the shoes, which is the preparation of the gospel of peace. I can stand every day peacefully because I know Jesus is going to fight my battles. So you put that whole armor on. You putting on spiritual armor. Then you go to God and ask him to fight your battles where Satan is going to attack you through the day. Eliminate, cut off this attack. See, that's why prayer is so important, that you can put on the armor. You can stand in his power. You can have him to fight your battles in the spiritual realm before they originate. If they originated, to have them eliminated.
Last question. Somebody who may be interested in learning more about modes of prayer, fasting, things like that, are there resources that you use to learn about them yourself? Are there any books or maybe websites that you can recommend to people?
I don't go on the websites too much. It's certain authors that I pick. I like John MacArthur, Tony Evans, Charles Stanley, Clarence Larkin, Oliver Green, John Phillips, Ironside. And I stay within these because I know that they're in the ballpark. And when, as you study, especially if you're going to preach or teach, you should have at least three or four commentators. If it's in the New Testament, see what they're saying in the Hebrew, along with what these men saying, and seeing what the Greek and the Hebrew is saying, and how the Spirit is leading me. It'll let you know if you're in the ballpark.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pastor John Harrison, thanks so much for coming by and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Converse Mountain Area Information Network, our parent company, and to Jason Holland, our station manager. I invite you to join myself, my guest, and the many fellow seekers in this world to build spiritual bridges and
Let us know by emailing feedback@wpvm.org.
WPVM.
Hi, this is Kay. I'm from The Bats, a band from New Zealand. You're listening to the Progressive Voice of the Mountains, WPVM LP Asheville, a broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network.
It's Sunday afternoon, and it's time for wordplay. Hi, I'm Jeff Davis, your host today for Wordplay. Joining me is my co-host, the beautiful Laura Hope Gill.
Thank you, Jeff. Hello, everybody.
Hello. How are you today, Laura?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Well, good, good. It was quite a week here in Asheville, wasn't it, for poetry?
It was indeed. Yeah. It was last time I saw Jeff, it was at the Robert Bly reading.
Yeah.
And what a gift to have him come through town.
Indeed.
And you did the workshop with him.
I did the workshop with him the day after, which was fabulous. Yeah.
Tell me all about it.
Well, let's see. I guess there were 35 of us. It was out in Madison County in a geodesic dome on the top of a hill with almost 360, viewing. And he had us work from text by Basho and by Rilke and from, in the afternoon, Ponge. And we would all talk about, the nature of the poems, the way the poems worked, and then write our own. And it was really a wonderful, wonderful exercise. Haven't done anything like that in years. It's good.
Did you write?
Yes, yes, yes. I didn't bring anything with me, but I did. The whole class wrote. I mean, we wrote four different poems during the day.
So you would submerge yourself in the works of the masters.
Right.
And how was, what was the context for the writing?
In the morning, what he did was provide initial lines. An initial line from Basho, an initial line from Rilke, or maybe two lines from Rilke. And then we would have to complete the poem.
Wonderful.
Yes, which was fabulous. It was. It was really a lot of fun. In the afternoon, what we did was walk around the grounds and find objects that we could write about. And I happened to find a piece, a dried sumac flower cluster. And so I wrote about that.
How perfect for you.
Yeah, of course.
Beautiful. What else did what did other people find?
A variety of flowers, small flowers. You know, the wildflowers that are blooming now in our hills here.
Right.
And sticks, stones, various and sundry objects. A fence post, you know.
Viscera, right.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. I wish you could have been there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it was from morning until late afternoon?
Right. Yeah, started at 10 and wound down at about 4:30 or so.
Right.
So a good long day, and we had a good lunch in between. So.
Well, good for Robert Bly.
Yeah, I mean, fine afternoon and morning.
Did you get to have lunch with him? Did you get to?
Yeah, we all ate lunch together and just sort of hung out, you know. Malaprops, our wonderful in-town bookstore here, independent bookseller, brought copies of his work out, and so they were for sale, and there were several people who had not been to the reading, so they were able to purchase his most recent stuff, which is fine indeed. I've been delving a little bit into it and really like the translations, the books of translations. He's been an incredible force in American poetry since when, about 1960 or something like that?
Yeah. Yes, and also our consciousness, one of our founders, the father of the men's movement back
in the 80s.
Yeah, he and always, Michael Mead.
Right. He's always been really engaged with the culture, you know, with the trying to help a new generation figure out how this thing, you know, this culture works, you know, or can be made to work in a way that's more kind and more, you know.
Compassionate.
Compassionate, yes, yes, right.
Which is the role of the poet, isn't it? I mean, the ancient role.
The ancient role. I think that's what's drawn Bly recently into the spiritual work that he's, you know, the spiritual poets, Hafez, Rumi, Ghalib, and the others. Wonderful, wonderful poets.
So. Right. Who are the other poets, do you think, around today that are working to advance our culture rather than, I guess the alternative would be to advance one's career.
Right. Well, Gary Snyder, I would say, certainly.
I beg your pardon?
Gary Snyder, I would say, would be one, certainly.
Right.
Who are the others? Most of the, I don't find that in the language poets or the avant-garde much. I mean, there's not much engagement there beyond, you know, with the larger context, the culture as a whole, that I can think of.
Right.
Yeah, I'm kind of, but of course there have been people like, Sonia Sanchez and, you know.
John Trudell.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Right.
Who are very much engaged.
Right. And that's such an interesting, at some point, a poet can cross a threshold where they become the speaker for the culture, the speaker for the spirit at the same time.
Right. The bard of the era or whatever.
Yes. And yeah. I felt when I was sitting there, we were both in the front row, smack dab in front of Robert Bly, that's the presence in which I found myself, was this is a man who has, I don't even want to say negated, but I was teaching a class on Langston Hughes this week, and one of the essays that I read with my students was about how Langston Hughes knew that he had to be the architect of something that did not yet exist.
Sure, right. In his case, I mean, yes, he was a
right, and a what it takes to be
right
an architect, where you just say, "Okay, this isn't built. I'm going to build it," and I have no idea right now how to do it, but God help me, I'm going to do it.
Here we go. This is the first nail.
Right, exactly. And I think that Bly has done this building thing. I'm going to build a movement. This is lacking. Yeah. I'm going to build it. And
he started with a new way to write poetry. I mean, to I mean, his deep image work back in the 60s was really a new way of approaching poetry for American poets.
Was it really? Why? What was going on when he started doing that?
Well, there was John Crow Ransom. There was, you know, there were the whole academic establishment of American poets. A much more conservative model for poetry. T.S. Eliot, as good as he was, still worked within a...
cerebral space?
Within a cerebral space.
Okay.
Bligh wanted to bring the heart back in. And
wow. You know,
the wildness of imagery, surrealism, you know, he was a proponent for the surrealist poets early on. And I think that had just terrific impact. I mean,
right. Now, you mentioned the language poets. I'm just... I've been thinking about them. I've been thinking about this movement among us. And I suppose that the benefit is to shake us up, to shake up our relationship to the language.
Sure.
Which is key in filling the words with new definitions.
Right.
And so far that's what I've come up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes I feel they're at war with the very signifying nature of language itself. And for me, that doesn't work necessarily. I mean, it does open up possibilities for, you know, context of meaning and so on. But
right.
But then I'm not sure where it goes. But yeah.
Right. From there.
From there. Right.
Right. Whereas with the image, and please, listeners, if we are stepping on toes, we welcome.
Yeah.
We do indeed welcome your comments and education. But I too am into the deep image and. Mm-hmm. I find that shakes us up as well in our relationship to signifiers as a way of being in the world. And
yeah. You know, Pound defined what was the three tools of the poet were logopoeia, phanopoeia, and melopoeia. Sound, image, and logic. And the language poets are working with the logic, you know, often
only.
Not with often not with sound, and hardly ever with image,
right?
And so they're throwing away like two of the toolkits,
yes,
that poets have presented to them,
right?
By the nature of their calling. So, yeah, it's interesting. Somebody has to do it, I guess. That's great.
Right, right. And the New York School and language poets, what's the connection there? Is there one? Is there...
sure.
You know, Kostolanitz, is he coming from the New York
School? He's more the New York School. Ted Berrigan, who is a New Yorker, New York School writer, but also played with signification in a way that opens his work also to the language poets. So he's sort of... straddles the schools, I guess it were. And of course, Ashbery, who's another New York school, or sort of he's a phenomenon into himself, but he's regarded highly by language poets and by New York school poets and by others. I mean,
right.
Ashbery's work is pretty big.
Our crossover, the J-Lo of the poetry world.
The J-Lo of the poetry world. All righty.
John, if you're out there.
Forgive us. You are listening to WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains.
We're going to read some Robert Bligh poems.
Let's read some
for
Robert
you.
Bligh.
I'm holding in my hands the book that I bought the other night, and which I'm happy to say is signed by Mr. Bligh himself. My sentence was 1,000 years of joy. It's a book of...
That's his most recent one, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. It is a collection of... And as a student of Aga Shahid Ali, I have to say it, guzzles.
Guzzles, excuse me. Yeah.
Guzzles.
Not guzzles. But
although
guzzles.
It sounds so much more romantic when Robert Bligh says guzzles.
Yes.
Or gazelles,
yes.
I think he called them. And of gazelles. Course, the image there was beautiful. However, Shahid guzzles. Was vehement.
Okay.
Adamant, every other kind of ant about its being guzzles.
Guzzles, okay.
So, and the guzzle form requires 35 syllables per stanza and a radif at the end, which acts like, I believe it's the radif, acts as a refrain. And Bligh does not maintain the refrain in all of these. However, he does maintain the 35 syllables and he does maintain the unity, the independent unity of thematic independence of each stanza, which is necessary.
The stanzas are what? Two lines? Three lines? What are they?
In the Arabic, they're two lines. In Bly, they are three.
That's right. He spoke about the difficulty of making a long line work in English.
Yes, so he said that it collapses.
Right. It collapses at 12 syllables.
You can't do it, which was so beautiful.
I thought that was nice.
And but Galway-Kinnell maintains two line stanzas. We'll need to do a comparison at a future show.
We should.
The guzzle slam. but the key about the guzzle, which is so great about it, it totally has to render you reasonless, because you will not find any narrative at all in the guzzle. And to write one, that's the great challenge, is getting rid of narrative, because you know you're going to write a long poem, but you cannot tell a story. So there has to be an independent theme in each stanza. When I am with you. When I am with you, two notes of the sarod carry me into a place where I am not. All the farms have disappeared into air. Those wooden fence posts I loved as a boy, I can see my father's face through their wood, and through his face, the sky as threshing ends. It is such a blessing to hear that we will die. 10,000 barks become 100,000. I know this friendship with myself couldn't last forever. Touch the sarod string once more, so that the finger that touched my skin a moment ago can become a lightning bolt that closes the door. Now I know why I keep hinting at the word you. The sound of you carries me over the border. We disappear the same way a baby is born. Some foolish boy with my name has been trying to peer all afternoon between the thick boards of the fence. Tell that boy, it isn't time.
Nice. Let me read a Bly poem, too. This is, you know, I noticed that when he was here, he didn't read any of his early work. On the day of the workshop, somebody requested that he read one from Light Around the Body, an early collection of his, and he did. But the early work is very different from this, from what you've just read for us. And so I want to read one from Silence in the Snowy Fields, which was his first full collection, published by Wesleyan, I believe, in 1962. So this is an oldie goldie. Poem Against the British. The wind through the box elder trees is like... The wind through the box elder trees is like rise at dusk on a white horse, wars for your country and fighting the British. I wonder if Washington listened to the trees. All morning I have been sitting in grass, higher than my eyes, beneath trees, and listening upward to the wind in leaves. Suddenly I realize there is one thing more. There's also the wind through the high grass. There are palaces, boats, silence among white buildings, iced drinks on marble tops among cool rooms. It is good also to be poor and listen to the wind. So that's a little different take. And
When I was listening to him talk, I was trying to gauge where he is on his own mystic journey, because he definitely has read and met and prayed with mystics and holy men from around the world. And, you know, one's always wondering, okay, has he crossed over? You know, has he gone all the way in? And I was... hearing that poem, it just reinforces in me that when we are in the poetic state, we've all gone over. When we're in that, when we're in that creative zone, what we see, what we perceive, and what we may not perceive when we're no longer writing the poem is literally it. And that poem just reinforces that for me.
Yeah. It's a way of getting there, isn't it? I mean, writing is.
Just touching that space.
Just for a moment, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's part of why we do it, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. Well, here's another early Bly. This is after the Industrial Revolution, all things happen at once. Bly was very, very active in the resistance to the Vietnam War back in the 60s and 70s. When I first heard him, in fact, it was 1970. He came to Buffalo to do a reading against the war. And there's a whole section of Light Around the Body that's politically engaged on that level. And this is one of them. This is the first of that section. After the Industrial Revolution, all things happen at once. Now we enter a strange world where the Hessian Christmas still goes on and Washington has not reached the other shore. The whiskey boys are gathering again on the meadows of Pennsylvania, and the Republic is still sailing on the open sea. I saw a black angel in Washington dancing on a barge, saying, "Let us now divide kennel dogs and hunting dogs." Henry Cabot Lodge in New York talking of sugar cane in Cuba. Ford in Detroit drinking mother's milk. Henry Cabot Lodge saying, "Remember the Maine." Ford saying, "History is bunk." And Wilson saying, "What is good for General Motors?" Who is it singing? Don't you hear singing? It is the dead of Cripple Creek. Coxey's army, like turkeys, are singing from the tops of trees, and the whiskey boys are drunk outside Philadelphia. So that was a look at the real turmoil. For those of you who don't remember, that was an era when we had an administration almost as morally...
Say it.
As our current one, which shall be unnamed. But yeah, it was a mess.
Right. It's interesting that he engaged the political.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely is the gateway into the spiritual. I think that's something that's undeniable. You have to fight for justice and walk for justice as a poet and engage and throw yourself in front of the barricades or whatever and learn that. I know in the Tao, it says that the Tao Te Ching, the one who shows that they care for all things will be trusted to care for all things.
Right.
And so the work, a great part of the work for poets is to get out of the house and or get out from, or at least direct the poet's poetic energy toward change and justice and the revolution.
Yeah, it certainly can be part of the poet's work. And Bly took it out into the public early on. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then later on in life, works for the spirit. It's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
And
read us another one.
This is another guzzle from My Sentence Was a Thousand Years of Joy. It's called Brahms.